And we'll start with film four up for review this evening, despite that we're in the middle of the summer, although the weather doesn't know that either, does it? We saw off the Avengers franchise recently with Endgame. Tonight we say farewell to the X-Men cycle with Dark Phoenix. Late Night sees Emma Thompson playing a cantankerous TV talk show host. Julianne Moore is Gloria, the free-spirited divorcee in Gloria Bell. And Papi Chulo is the unlikely title of the Irish-produced but LA-based film about a TV weatherman forced to take gardening leave, directed by John Butler, that particular one. Paul Whittington, Yvonne Nolan have been to see all four, and they're both with me in studio now. Bye-bye, X-Men franchise. Are you sad to see it go, Paul? You know, if you put in Deadpool 1 and 2, you're up around 14 or 15 movies, aren't you?
Yeah, if you add them in, and actually this is not quite the end, because Disney, which has taken over Fox, has a film called something, it's New Mutants or something like
all
that.
Right.
But that is the final, that's it, and it's sort of analogous to this. It's not, so this is really the final main one. It depends, because some of them were quite good, they've had their moments. They seem quite original in the early 2000s. Bryan Singer directed the first two, and they had good actors in them, obviously, which was something new for these kind of films.
Yeah, because you had Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen were kind of these. They were the kind of the stalwarts at the very beginning of the series.
Yeah,
the franchise.
They were Charles Xavier and Eric.
Lenson.
That guy, Magento.
Yeah.
And they were both mutants, and they had opposing views as to whether they could coalesce with humanity or not. And they did those, and they did a few spin-offs.
I love the way we throw off. They were both mutants and had to decide whether they could coalesce with humanity or not.
Mutants, they got through those. They did a few spin-offs, and then they very cleverly actually went back in time in 2011 with X-Men. First Class, which they went back to the early days of Charles Xavier and Magento.
Patrick Stewart became Michael Fassbender, and who do you call him? Ian McKellen became James McAvoy.
And they also decided to allied their stories with history, like the Cuban Missile Crisis and one. And then they turned up in Tricky Dicky Nixon's Washington in 1973. And the second one, they were quite clever, actually.
So they did then manage as mutants to coalesce with humanity.
Well, they briefly did. I don't want to get too complicated. Because they went back in time in the Richard Nixon to alter their futures so that it wouldn't be destroyed, so they haven't got on with them that well.
Oh, and let me just put the lid back on Pandora's box.
To alter their futures so the franchise could continue for another decade.
There's
basically
more if you want it.
Let's just put the lid on it. But to explain for those who maybe haven't seen many of the mutant is a kind of a somebody who's something has happened to them and they have got superpowers as a result.
Yeah, well, seemingly, you know, Stan Lee, who wrote a lot of the original stories, came up against a kind of a writer's block where, you know, he looked at all the others, the superheroes, and they all had something happen to them that gifted them their powers. And so he was sick of trying to think of new ways of getting superpowers. So he thought, well, what about if you're born with these superpowers? And thus the idea of mutants began. Right. It was a way out of
a
hole.
So they were actually born super powerful.
They were born super powerful.
And it became a very handy analogy ahead of its time in the early X-Men films, because it was talking about, you know, difference and inclusion and all those kind of things. So that was quite a clever aspect of it, I suppose.
Which isn't there at all now.
But they were funny. And I think the humour was an important element of the early part of the franchise.
Yeah, but I was in here a few weeks ago talking to you about the new Avengers film. Infinity War, which was the end of that series. But, it is sophisticated, Shakespearean, operatic filmmaking compared to the wooden
and
paper
I have a
thin
vague memory of you tearing that particular Avengers film apart slowly.
No, my recollection was I liked it well enough. I mean, because I was surprised. I'd done all my swatting of watching the Avengers films that led up to it, and I was really pleasantly surprised. And I mean, there was loads of beautiful comedy in it and everything.
Right,
and
so
there was loads of character exposition. You know, in this we've got where they're messing around with the overall chronology of the X-Men films, and so having exploited all other areas of time, they now settle for the 1990s.
The space shuttle is involved as a result of that, isn't it?
It is. Sophie Turner, who people will know from Game of Thrones, is in this. She plays Jane.
Out of a job now.
Out of a job, yeah. And maybe after
think
this,
probably
I had another job.
Yeah, but another franchise ending on her.
Yeah, but I think she probably will do okay. But she plays Jane Grey in this, who people will remember from some of the earlier films, maybe if they're fans. She is one of the most powerful mutants, and she has this incredible inner kinesis, if you like, that she can't control when she becomes emotional. And this film, we find out how she got it, because it's 1992. They go up to space to save a space shuttle, the crew of a space shuttle, and she confronts and ingests what seems like a solar flare, but it's not. And she comes back down, and she seems all right, but she really isn't.
Okay.
Simultaneously to that,
and she's Phoenix, and then now we're talking Dark Phoenix is the name.
Yeah,
of the film,
she is exactly.
Things are not going to be darker for.
That's
Phoenix.
A clue. Yeah. But simultaneous to that, a group of not very pleasant aliens have arrived on Earth, led by Jessica Chastain.
And is her character called?
Look or looks or
Vuk or Vuk.
Let's go with Vuk.
Yeah,
and you sense that there are problems ahead when they start speaking in their own language with subtitles, and
Vukish,
just think, oh my God, maybe. The thing about this film is there are lots of it's got a bad script, and it seems very rushed coda to this series. There are a lot of good actors in it, but they're not given much to
do. Yeah, but let me play a clip using two of those good actors. I think we could probably agree that James McAvoy and Jennifer Lawrence can both act.
Yes.
Fairly acceptable.
Yeah.
So Raven,
and Michael Fassbender.
And Michael Fassbender is in here as well. There are lots of them that can act, but the clip that I have has Jennifer Lawrence and James McAvoy, and basically she's upset with him about something. She's a great end line, has to be said, in this clip.
You put us in danger, Charles. You put those kids in danger.
They're not kids anymore, Raven. And I care about their safety just as much as you do.
Are you sure about that? Because we're taking bigger and bigger risks. And for what? Please, tell me it's not your ego. Being on the cover of magazines, getting a medal from the president. You like it, don't you?
As opposed to being hunted and despised. Well, you know, actually, I do. It's all just a means to an end, Raven.
What end is that?
Keeping us safe. You should understand better than anyone that we're only ever one bad day away from them starting to see us as the enemy again.
So what? We wear matching costumes and smile in pictures
that
to make everyone feel safe?
That is a small price to pay for keeping the peace.
By risking our people to save theirs.
Yes, yes.
It's funny. I can't actually remember the last time you were the one risking something. And by the way, the women are always saving the men around here. You might want to think about changing the name to X-Women.
You must have loved that line of Vaughan Nolan.
Yeah,
well, the only funny
line.
The only line.
I mean, the movie continues to be called X-Men, you know, in the same way as you know, in Avengers, the female characters get kind of a set piece, kind of, you know, this is our little nod to the Me Too movement. I mean, it's all quite cynical, really. But the thing about, you know, the whole tension in it this time is, you know, the benevolent Dr. Xavier, who has, founded this college for, you know, talented youth who are mutants. His morals are in question. I mean, not alone has he put people in danger, but has he put them in danger for reasons that are to do with self-aggrandizement and selfishness rather than, you know, defending humanity?
Okay, so
he hits the sauce a bit as well in this, I noticed. I've never noticed it before any of those
times. Xavier?
Oh, he hits the scotch pretty heavily. Yeah.
No, okay. Is it worth going to see? Do you need to wrap up or half wrap up?
I suppose if you had seen all the other ones, it would be worth going to see. But if you compare it to the film called Logan, made 2 years ago, that I actually interviewed Patrick Stewart for, and that was, you were saying about Shakespeare, that actually was Shakespeare. It was fantastic. It was confronting things like, you know, death and aging and everything.
Yeah.
But this is, it's just total surface.
So you weren't happy. Stars for you, Paul.
2 for me.
And Yvonne, you weren't happy. Stars
for
you.
1 for me for just making it to the cinemas.
Just for getting it into the...
Just for getting it into distribution.
That's right. I think you can probably guess what both Yvonne and Paul think in terms of X-Men Dark Phoenix. Then let's move on to late night. We're in the world of late night talk show hosts. Catherine Newbury, played by Emma Thompson, is the host in question here. A woman who makes Donald Trump sound politically correct is what it says on my script in front of me. Yes. And like all good hosts, I read exactly what's on the script.
Well, it's true. It's true. Catherine Newbury doesn't care about anything like a Me Too movement or helping other women up the ladder or anything like that. She's single-minded and focused on her own career, but only up to a point. In a kind of a tired autopilot way, she cares terribly about her, you know, 30-year run on this late-night chat show. Not to mention the fact that there's never been a late night chat show on American TV hosted by a woman.
Because yeah, Ellen has always been daytime.
Yeah. So she's there. She's doing her gig. She's interviewing, you know, writers and politicians and really, you know, interesting people to her. But she's losing her audience. They don't like who she's interviewing. And
it's all male. Every writer on the series.
And so
is male.
Behind the scenes, and the people who never are allowed to enter the studio are this team of script writers. Who are supposed to write all her gags and spend their days trying to write jokes. But it comes to a sorry pass when a new female studio head is appointed. She looks at the figures, knows the show isn't doing well, and, you know, says things have to change around here. This coincides with a young woman, her name is Molly, who works for a chemical company in Pennsylvania. Now, bear with me on this. She has won a prize in her chemical company in Pennsylvania to meet someone important from the corporation. And very cleverly, she realises that the corporation that owns the chemical company also owns a TV network.
And, she's
and by this
in
way,
writing.
She talks right. herself into a role in the writer's room, and she's pretty much brought in as an intern. She also ticks boxes that the studio head is keen to see ticked now. She's a woman of colour. So she's ticking two boxes there, and the all-male writing room are disgusted at her arrival.
Well, let's listen to the all-male writing room. Catherine Newbury, Emma Thompson is in this, obviously, as the long-standing host. And Lucas Caleb... Lucas Caleb Rooney. Is the character called Caleb as well? I think he might be. Or maybe he's Lucas Rooney. Anyway, here he is. You'll hear him as the character here. And he has the temerity to suggest that he might get a pay rise. His reason for the pay rise? Have a listen.
Jen and I just had our second baby, Taylor. So there's just a lot of expenses at home right now. And I think it's time for a raise.
This is actually very exciting to me.
Really? Great.
Because what you're describing is the most clear-cut example of the classic sexist argument for the advancement of men in the workplace. You're asking for a raise not because of any work-related contribution you've made, but simply because you have a family. And that's why in the 1950s, family men were promoted over the women they worked with.
I don't think that's at all what's happening.
I can't give you a raise, Gabe. It's like giving a raise to a drug addict.
What?
Well, your situations are virtually identical. A drug addict makes certain decisions outside of work for their sense of self and comfort, and then the addiction demands more time, more energy, more money, just like a child.
My child's like a drug problem?
Exactly. You want special treatment. I'm sure you can see how unfair that would be to a single man or woman.
There are no women on this staff. And the reason there aren't any women is because you hate women.
We need to hire a woman. You're fired, obviously.
There we go, Emma Thompson as Catherine Newbury, who clearly doesn't need any writers if she can work things out like that for herself. And the character is called Gabe, the actor is called Lucas Caleb Rooney
exchange.
He
does get fired, too.
To what extent, it obviously touches on arguments around sexism. Mm. To what extent is that, in the workplace in particular, to what extent is that explored any further than that type of comedy situation?
Not very deeply, Paul. I don't think. Mindy Kaling, who plays Molly, also wrote the screenplay, and people will know her from The American Office. She's a very clever writer, and there's some decent writing in this film. But it actually doesn't really go, you think it's going to, and then it doesn't, because it actually becomes quite a conventional comedy, perfectly decent comedy actually, about the relationship between Emma Thompson's character and Mindy Kaling's character, because when she comes in she makes all these gaffes and most of the men are pretty mean to her, not all of them, and then it turns out that she actually is a good writer. And it's all about. And meanwhile, Emma Thompson's character is having all sorts of. She's under threat. Basically, they want to get rid of her, and personal stuff starts coming out. So that's the dynamic, and really, the film boils down to that.
Yeah, and is it a wasted opportunity or a missed opportunity that we don't get into any of those dynamics within the workplace, or is it just a comedy and a good performance from Emma Thompson, and we should take it at that face level in that respect?
Well, I think Mindy Kaling. would go about this with a light touch. So I think really everything you need to think about how to survive in an all-male workplace is exposed through how her character works at the male writing table. And I mean, the main thing she has going for is she's got a clear pair of eyes, and she watches the she's watched the programme, which people who work on it don't really watch the programme.
So do you think then that in fact it does touch on the misogyny and the sexism in the workplace?
It does. I mean, she has a relationship with one of her colleagues from the writing table, yeah. And it emerges very quickly that you know, his game is to kind of kind of cast shade on her, really, you know, and she soon realizes that and puts an end to it. But you know, she is determined. It's a real study in her determination, even when people think she's a ghastly, over-impressed ingenue. She keeps going. She sticks to her guns. And you know what? You know, when it comes to what should we do to save the show, she's got the 10 best ideas.
Right. And Emma Thompson, everybody's saying, is brilliant in this. Do you both
agree? She is very good in it. And it's nice to see her in the middle of a film as opposed to at the side of a film. She's great. She really dominates the film. As I said, I think it's a perfectly decent comedy. I don't think it's 30 Rock in terms of that kind of cleverness, but it's perfectly decent.
Stars from you, Yvonne?
3.5 stars from me.
All right. And from you, Paul?
3 from me.
All right. So you had a reasonably good time with that one. Let's move on to film number 3, Gloria Bell. Originally a Chilean film by Sebastian Lelio, if that's how I say his name correct. It was simply called Gloria, but it's redirected by Mr. Lelio again, this time in the English language. Shot for shot, I'm told, exactly the same as the previous film, but obviously the setting is different. We're now in LA as opposed to Chile.
Yeah.
So what's Julianne Moore's situation in this?
So Julianne Moore's situation is she's 12 years divorced and she's got a pretty ordinary job. What she does is what she likes to do is she goes to singles nightclubs for older people. The film opens with her standing at the bar, what people are all dancing behind her. So she cuts a very lonely figure and she turns around and she takes in the room. And you can really feel that barrier between her and everybody else and her real aloneness. And the rest of the scenes in the opening of the film kind of, you know, really emphasise that. You see her going to work the next day, trying to phone her adult son and daughter and only getting their voicemail. They don't pick up to her. And then you see her coming home to her empty apartment and the Sphinx cat that wanders in from next door and the man upstairs who's doing crack and who raves and rants all night. And that's her life. And sorry, just to say that the way it's lit and the way it's shot further enhances the gloominess and the banality of her life. It's a portrait in desperation, one would think. That's how it's set up.
That's where you think you're heading. But enter John Turturro, and what happens, Paul?
Yeah, well, he plays... I think that Gloria is... She's a survivor. Maybe her life isn't perfect, but she's quite go-ahead. She does everything with a smile. But she is a bit lonely, and she becomes hopeful when she meets Arnold, who's John Turturro, and he's this kind of sweet and kind of diffident divorcee who makes a great fuss for taking her for dinner. But he is not his own man. His ex-wife and these two terrifying daughters of his, who are like something from Greek mythology when we eventually see them, they won't leave him alone. And when one of them, like, you know, cracks a nail or something, they ring him up and look for him to do something, and he does it. And Gloria begins to realise that he's never entirely there.
Yeah, so now we're kind of set up for both of them saving each other in different ways.
Yes.
Is that where we head?
Although the first night she meets him, she brings him home. And it's kind of quite funny in a gentle way. As she unbuttons his shirt and then there's a sound of Velcro ripping and it turns out he's wearing a
surgical corset.
And this is older love, it seems.
Yeah. And let's not say why he's wearing that corset, because I think that's maybe, there's a kind of a little twist that there are reasons there and a kind of a sadness in his life that's exposed about it.
There definitely is, and there's loads of other complexities. I mean,
he's not unsympathetic.
No, he's not. No. He's very sympathetic. He's this kind of, you know, gentle, probably quite ineffectual man. Later on, she brings him to her son Peter's birthday party that her ex-husband and his wife are attending.
Very funny scenes.
It is one of the best scenes of tension at a dinner table I've ever watched.
Yeah, so now we seem to be in. So we've gone from, we're looking at a thing of desperation into, they're going to save each other. Mm. Now, again, tension between old couples seems to be part of it. What do we actually get, and does it work as a film? It sounds interesting.
It's just like the original. It's a very adult film, and it's very rich. You know, you one could ask why he would do it again, because in a sense, you're right, it's shot for shot, but by moving it from Chile to Los Angeles, we have a totally different film, in the sense that he's able to bring in, you know, the Californian refusal to accept the idea of age and death and so on. He brings all that in. She goes to all these hilarious classes, which seem different than the ones in Chile. And also Julianne Moore, who I believe asked him to do this. That's what they say anyway.
Yeah, isn't she an executive producer on the film? Yes.
She is. The disco dancing isn't as much to the fore in this one as it was in the original one, but then you realise why, because he holds it back, and there's this absolutely tremendous scene at the end where you realise just what a good actor she is, if you didn't realise before.
Right. So this sounds as if
she has it all the way through, though.
Yeah,
I mean,
she does.
Julianne Moore in a close-up shot, the slightest facial expression change can carry so much. She's such a wonderful actor, and I've never seen her in anything where I thought, God, she's pretty crappy in that.
She did Still
she's
Alice.
She's wonderful.
And 10-minute interview, she gave as much as many people would give in an hour-long interview.
Yes,
she's really generous
she's
in that
really
respect.
Talented.
So, you both like this film. Stars from you this time first, Paul?
4.5.
4.5. Why does it not get in 5?
Because because it's not the original, I suppose.
Okay.
It's a remake, but it's very, very good.
And what are you saying about?
3.5 again for me, because I felt that where it goes in the end is quite conventional. In the sense of what you might want a female character doing after what Julianne passes through. Yeah.
All right, let's move on to our fourth and final film then, from the director of Stag, Handsome Devil, John Butler, produced by Rebecca O'Flanagan and Rob Walpole. Setting of the film, Papi Chulo was not Ireland at all, but LA in the world of it. We're back in the world of TV again, and this time with Sean the Weatherman.
Yeah, and you have to admire the ambition of both producers and director for making an Irish film in Los Angeles. I talked to them before they did it, and it was a very brave thing to do, and it looks beautiful.
It's a side of LA that we don't see, really.
Well, there's a couple of sides. First, there's the I can't remember which canyon they shot it in, but it's sort of in the hills, and this is where this main character, the Weatherman, lives. And then also we see some of more towards sort of South Central LA, where the other protagonist lives. But in any case, Sean Astin Matt Bomer is Sean,
the
where I got Sean Astin from. Matt Bomer is Sean. He's a TV weatherman, and he basically has a breakdown on air. He becomes upset, and it's terrible, and it's kind of fascinating to watch.
And the Papi Chulo character then of the title, Ernesto is the character here.
Yes, so after his breakdown on air, he's told to take some time off, quite forcibly, by the head of the station, who's like our other studio head we mentioned earlier, who's very keen on her viewing figures and so on, doesn't want people to be upset. She's more concerned about viewer upset than the upset of poor man in front of her. So anyway, he's commanded to go on leave. You see him go back to his house. There's a beautiful blossom tree on his deck.
Perfect house.
That he wants to get rid of. And when the blossom tree is collected by two people and taken away, there's a patch on the deck that's a different colour to the rest. He decides he needs to get more paint, and in getting more paint, he manages to acquire a Mexican day labourer. There would be a gang of guys outside the hardware shop every day looking for work.
Who speaks only Spanish, and Sean speaks very little Spanish, mostly English. Let's listen to an exchange between the two of them.
Right through here. There it is. L.A.
Es más que un día.
It's more than one day? It's just a little circle.
Sí, pero hay mucho que hacer. Mira, hay que lijar todo esto. Es más que un día.
I don't know what that means, but more than one day is in there, I guess?
Es more one day.
More than one day. 2 days?
No sé, pero es más que un día.
It's more than one day.
More one day.
It's más que one day.
It's more one day.
Más que one day. Got it. Yep.
Yeah, más que un día. More than one day. As you may, my Spanish fairly clearly stretches a big distance as well. Alejandro Patino there as Ernesto and Matt Bomer as Sean the Weatherman. But it's the relationship that builds from that. I don't have to ask you about this yet, Yvonne, have I? The relationship that builds from that initial encounter is quite a gentle and beautiful one.
Sean has been advised to deal with his grief, and we don't know yet what his grief is, because we think it's a breakup with his boyfriend.
And we're not going to say what it
is. And he's told to deal. He should, like, you know, talk to real people in real time and not be using apps or anything else. So Ernesto is pretty much the first other human being he encounters, and he decides to use him as a sounding board. And in many ways, it doesn't matter that Ernesto doesn't. Doesn't understand all he says. And then
he has to listen.
To add further comedy to all the misunderstandings and blank looks, there's a device that Butler uses where Ernesto rings his wife Linda to tell her in Spanish what's going on. And so, that's given subtitles. Every time he makes the phone call, and he's saying, "You won't believe it. I'm rowing on a lake."
And Ernesto, even the thought of being in the same area as a gay man would generally make him have difficulty.
Well,
I just think it's
a world he's not familiar to.
He's not familiar with it.
He seems to adapt remarkably well. He's taken to all these very, fancy parties, and it's all very funny. And he's befriended by all these people, and he just kind of smiles and nods and goes through it all. Helped, as you say, by the fact that his English is bad, so he doesn't have to listen to them half the time. I think he does start to warm to Sean and to actually care about him as we eventually see towards the end.
There's a fabulous scene on the way back from one of those parties held by a gay couple who were friends of Sean's, and in the taxi on the way home, Sean and Ernesto are a bit tipsy in the back of the cab, and they're singing Madonna's Borderline, and it is a great funny piece of cinema. In fact, the jokes, visual and in script, come all the way through really relentlessly to when we get to a turning point in the film.
Yeah.
And then they resume again.
All right, so we better wrap at that. Stars from you, Yvonne.
The stars from me are 4.5. I just think that Butler's ability to extract subtle humour from even quite dark circumstances, and his fundamental belief in human goodness.
He's really
ploughing a furrow of his own now. I really think that John Butler is coming into the height of his powers.
Yeah, because I know we spoke to him.
No one else can do it like he can.
Yeah, we spoke to him about this a while back because it was in the festival circle, I guess, at this time, but it's only coming to Ireland now in the general release or into the ordinary cinemas, I suppose. What do you say, stars? Paul?
3.5 for me. There's lots of things I admire in this film, but I thought that it was on less firm ground once it went to the Spanish neighbourhood and so on. I felt that we really understand what was going on but a lot of good things.
All right, a lot of good things to be said then about Papi Chulo, which along with Gloria Bell, they're both on limited release actually, while the two big ones, X-Men Dark Phoenix and Late Night, are on general release. And we should correct something, thank you to Tony, who tells us that Joan Rivers hosted her own late night talk show.
There were 9 episodes, I believe.
Back in 1986.
Good man, Tony.
So I'm not unaware.
He says in the 1990s and first aired in October 1986 on Fox Network. There you go, progressive must have been back then.